This podcast is brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. One of the big names in the Australian music industry. He's been frontman with the worldwide successful Men at Work and also has a very successful solo career. And he also plays and sings with Ringo Starr and his all-star band. He is, of course, Scottish-Australian musician, singer, songwriter, actor and all-round nice guy, Colin Hay. And here's the tour dates for Colin Hay. Saturday, June 29, Costa Hall Geelong, Performing Arts Centre, and there's extra seats available. Sunday, June 30, Hamer Hall, Melbourne Arts Centre, extra seats available there. Wednesday, 3rd of July, Big Red Bash up at Birdsville. Friday, 5th of July, Enmore Theatre in Sydney. Saturday, the 6th of July, Newcastle Civic Centre. And Sunday, the 7th of July, Anita's Theatre, Thirroul.
Hi, this is Colin Hay, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
Born in Kilwinning in Scotland, or was it Saltcoats? I'd like to find out about your early years, Colin. Where is Kilwinning?
It's a very small town in the county of Ayrshire, southwest coast of Scotland. That's basically the hospital. I was born in Kilwinning Hospital. But then we moved about 4 miles to Saltcoats.
Okay. Well, how was your early life there? Did you enjoy it?
I had a pretty idyllic childhood, I have to say. I was brought up from the age of 5 until I was 14 in a music shop. So we lived behind and above a music shop in Saltcoats, which was just a small record shop. But, you know, between the years of 1958 and 1967 was when we had the music shop. So you can imagine that the amount of incredible music that got made during that time. I didn't even realize it at the time. It's more when I got older that I realized the impact that just being in the center of that, of all that had. You know, on a Monday, they would bring in the freshly printed 7-inch singles that I would play, you know, in the shop. And it was a brilliant environment. And then it was next to the sea. You know, it was basically a little B&B town, although after when Britain joined the common market, everyone started going to Spain and Portugal. So the town, died quite a lot, as a lot of places did in that part of the world, because that's where all the Glasgow people used to go for their holidays. I had a lovely upbringing. It was nothing wrong with it.
Any brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I have an older brother and a younger sister. My brother's in New Zealand and my sister is in Melbourne.
Oh, sensational. Oh, well, that's great. You'll be able to see them all when you come down.
It's one of the reasons I do come down, is to see my family.
How was school for a young Colin Hay?
School in Scotland was quite traditional, you could say. I mean, teachers used to still wear cloaks. It was quite a high standard of education in Scotland when I went to school. I came to Australia quite bright. I kind of became a little bit more of an idiot the longer I was there. I kind of didn't do as well academically in Australia as what I did in Scotland. Maybe it had something to do with playing music, but I don't think it did. I was just lazy. I didn't study enough.
So when did you, Father Jim and Mother Isabella, when did you take the huge leap to sail down under?
In June 1967, well, May 1967.
And how was the transition for you? Did you cope?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting subject. I mean, I was lucky because, I mean, I got picked on a little bit, but not as much as a lot of other people. You know, when you go to a new country and a new school, I remember what it was like if somebody came to my school in Scotland, you know, as a new boy, you know, or girl. I don't know what it was like for girls, but if you were a lad and you came to our school, well, you just got hammered. You know, and it was merciless. And I was even in our town. That's not even going to a school in Glasgow. So I was prepared for all kinds of hell to break loose when I got to Australia. There was there were some English guys, and then there was some Italians and Greeks and that I used to play football with down the street. And they used to get all kinds of disparaging name calling and bullying and stuff like that when they first arrived in Australia. So, of course, you know, people think it's funny, you know, but it's just really mean-spirited is the best thing you can say about it. But I seemed to cope all right. I didn't get hassled too much. And the more time I spent in Melbourne, my accent changed. When I would go home to my mother and father, I would speak like this because I always had a Scottish accent growing up. And then, of course, when I was in Australia for a short period of time, I started speaking like an Australian bloke just to assimilate, you know. So I go out in the street and I speak like to my Australian friends and just to not be different. And as soon as I went back into my parents' house, I started speaking like this again, like a Scottish guy. So I always had the two accents going unconsciously. When I left Australia and came to live here some 34 years ago, or however long ago it was, it's like somebody pressed a reset button and the Scottish one was the one that remained.
Tobin Brothers believe every life is unique. Every funeral should be too. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au.
Hi, this is Colin Hay, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
I know we both ended up in the same suburb of Beaumaris. I know, Jim, your father was the piano tuner at Channel 9 and a stage singer and dancer in Glasgow. So it was really in you right from the start, wasn't it?
Yeah, my father was a great singer and a great dancer and was a child prodigy, as a matter of fact, when he was growing up. But he gave it up when he was a teenager for one reason or another. I mean, there were lots of extenuating circumstances. When he was not much past, I think he was 17 when the war broke out. So he was in the British, in the Air Force, in the war. So that tends to curtail one's entertainment aspirations. You know, he was kind of an artist, really, in a way. He had a lot of things to say, but it was unfulfilled. He never went for that. So instead he went for something which was kind of related to it, tuning pianos. So he had a very good ear and he did an apprenticeship for that. That's what he ended up doing. But he always had a kind of an ear, and he could write really well, you know. So I sometimes used to write me little verses, you know, and say, what do you think of this, you know. And I'd come home and he'd have the television on and it was blaring loud, you know. And I'd walk in and he'd go, hey, do you know that guy Snoopy Dogg? He goes, he's good, I like that guy. You know, and he says, I wrote a poem when I was listening to him, you know, so he used to get inspired by Snoop when he would watch him on the telly.
That's fantastic. I mean, what a guy. I still have a little note from him. When I played Who Can It Be Now on 3XY for the first time in Breakfast, we used to call Jim the laddie's daddy. He wrote me a lovely thank you note saying, thanks for playing my son's song, signed the laddie's daddy.
Even towards the end of his life, he'd go and have a coffee, and then on his way home, he would stop at JB Hi-Fi, put all my CDs up the front of the rack, and then he'd walk home.
What a guy. I love him. Now, they had a record store just like in Scotland. They had a record store in Melbourne. Is that correct?
No, they didn't have a record store. My mother worked at Sutton's, and my father tuned pianos for Brash's for a long time. You know, he didn't last long there because they didn't pay him enough money.
You worked in the record store too, didn't you?
I worked in Sutton's. I always had jobs, you know. And the holidays, I used to work at wherever my mother worked, she would get me a job, you know. I worked at McEwan's, that place in the city. I don't think it's there anymore. And then I worked at Sutton's for a while. And then I worked at the Record Centre in Bourke Street.
Did you have previous bands before Men at Work, or was that the first band that you had?
I was in bands from when I was about 14 years old, but they were short-lived. But I always used to just play primarily on my own, just play acoustic guitar and sing. So that was my natural game, if you like. And I had a band after I finished school in 1972. I went up to Sydney to see if I could make it, and came running home after a few months with my tail between my legs. Realized that it was going to be harder than I thought it was going to be. So, and I used to just sing with bands in Sydney. I would just audition and kind of, you know, sing in covers bands and stuff like that. And then I came back to Melbourne. I think I'd disappointed my parents, you know, by not going to any tertiary institution. So I got a letter from La Trobe University saying I could go to university if I wanted, because I passed leaving, but, you know, I didn't get into the prestigious universities like Melbourne and Monash. I ended up going to La Trobe, which I really loved. I loved La Trobe. It was probably the most radical of the universities at the time, which I liked. And I met some really, really important people during that time. So I did a university degree in nothing in particular, you know, an arts degree, which is pretty useless. But it enabled me to bide my time. It enabled me to write songs. It enabled me to play a lot of guitar and just kind of try and figure out how to put something together and have some kind of strategy. I wasn't sure what that was going to be. And when I finished university, very soon after that, I met Ron Stryker, the other guitar player. And that was a key thing for me, because Ron was brilliant and he was very inspiring to work with. So I said to him, I got a job as a singer in this musical called Ned Kelly. I said, when I come back from this musical, you and I should do something together. So he said, okay. So we started working together about a year before Men at Work formed, and that was the nucleus of the band, if you like.
And having a residency at the Cricketers Arms, that helped, because all of a sudden, you know, you're in front of record company people and lots of other A&R people. And there was one guy from CBS Records, I think it was back then. He really took to the band.
Yeah, well, Ron and I played at the Cricketers Arms for like almost a year, I think, before Men at Work formed. So we'd kind of built up this audience just playing there on a Thursday night. And then Jerry Spicer, the drummer, joined Ron and I. And so we had a three-piece for a minute. And then Greg, who I'd known for years, he joined us. So in the course of maybe 2 or 3 months, we had the band. The band was happening. But we never really had a lot of record company interest in us. And we mainly had this following of just regular people, punters who'd come along and on their payday on a Thursday night, and we became kind of like people's Thursday night band. And so the Cricketers Arms was quite special in that regards. And we played on every Wednesday night at the Pier Hotel in Frankston. And that's a big room, you know, and we would only attract a couple of hundred people. But Bill Joseph, the guy that booked us there, he believed in us. He saw something in us. And and there was one guy from CBS Records. Anyway, he wasn't an A&R guy. He was in sales. He used to, you know, go to the A&R department and at CBS, and he put Men at Work signs. He kind of nail people's phones to the desk to try and get their attention. And eventually, Peter Carpen came down to see the band. And even then, they only gave us a deal for a single, you know. And so they didn't really have that much confidence in us, really. We recorded Who Can It Be Now, and it went to number two. If we had released Who Can It Be Now and it hadn't done anything, I really doubt that we would have been given a record deal in the first place. So it all depended on that first single, which was thankfully did well. But yeah, there's a lot of talk about record companies. For example, we were only interested in a multinational label. You know, we were never interested in signing with a national label like Mushroom, or there's always that great story about our dear pal Michael, who said that he always regretted never signing Men at Work. Well, we would never have signed with him, because I had friends that had, you know, were signed to Mushroom, and they were always just complaining, you know, and he hadn't had success overseas. And so that's what we wanted. You know, we were very ambitious in that regard. So it was very lucky for us that CBS were the ones that, you know, which became Sony, were the ones who gave us a deal. And it was a completely horrendous deal. You know, it was just almost criminal, I would say. You know, it was just a very, very cynical deal that they gave us, you know, and we wanted to make a record. So that's the power dynamic that often happens, is the record company has all the cards, you know, because the artist just wants to make a record. And it's a lot, I think people are a lot more savvy now to actually at least get a good lawyer and get it looked at and get the best deal you can when you're signing with a label, because we were just so dumb. And as Paul would say, you know, we did all the dumb things.
Well, you know, the record companies offered promotion and stages and all of that. But yeah, I hear you. I know exactly. That's why everybody's self-promoting on YouTube and doing a fair job at it, because cream always rises to the top.
Well, sometimes it does, and sometimes it just gets demoralized, you know. I don't know about that, actually. Sometimes there's a lot of other stuff that rises to the top, but I wouldn't call it cream.
Now, for Men at Work, the world just blew up for you as your first two albums, Business as Usual in 81, Cargo in 83, and Two Hearts in 85. Those albums were number one almost all over the world. And I also remember your golf club on Countdown, which I thought was different and typical of Colin Hay. It gave you that point of difference, but the songs were brilliant. 1994, Men at Work, inducted into the ARIA Hall of Fame. 2020, Distinguished Services Award and the Ted Albert Award for Outstanding Services to Australian Music in the APRA Awards. That was your award, and also 15 studio albums. And I must congratulate you now for Down Under, 1 billion streams. I mean, how massive is that?
Well, it's a lot.
Yes, it is a lot. Congratulations, mate. Well done.
Thank you.
Now, for Colin Hay, 15 studio albums. And I also loved your wife Cecilia's Latin album with her singing, you know, the big rock anthems with the Latin beat and that fat brass and rhythm. I love that album. Did you produce that album for her?
No. She kind of produced it herself. She's a great producer, but she had a co-producer on that. The record was called Havana Rocks. Yeah, it's a great record. No, I was here to help. I think I did some engineering for her, but I was not the producer.
Right. 1989, off to America and Topanga Canyon. Another big move, taking the big step. Was it easy for you?
Well, there were a lot of things pointing me away from Australia at that point. I had a record deal offered to me based out of Los Angeles, so I had something to go to. I was getting divorced at the time. I was having trouble with a drink, and so I was kind of struggling, I have to say, personally and professionally. So I thought, well, maybe a new scene is somewhere where I'm completely anonymous, much, much more so than I was walking around St. Kilda. So I came here. I didn't really come here with any great plan. I just came to kind of wipe the slate clean and start again, and I'd given up the drink. And so in some ways, I felt like I wanted to be heading towards some kind of light. Los Angeles provided that for me. You know, it didn't make any demands of me. It just said, okay, you know, if you want to do something, you can do it. You know, if you have the energy and the talent, if you like. So I had a deal with MCA Records, which was it was short-lived. And so they dropped me after one record. And so my tenure with big record labels was pretty much done. And so I just stayed here and I went on the road. And I went on the road playing to nobody pretty much for 10, 15 years. I would tour the States and different parts of the world and just went out there to try and find an audience. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
Congratulations, mate. I've got to take my hat off to you because that's a big, bold move, because I knew you were doing that. I knew you were building an audience around the States. And that's like Keith Urban did in Nashville. You know, it's a real long, hard slog. And you've now built up a Colin Hay audience. And I'm very proud of you for doing that.
Thanks. Yeah, it was just like, it wasn't even, you know, design. It was really just circumstance. You know, if you get dropped and you don't have an agent, not that I wanted a manager or anything, but I just thought, okay, well, I'm in this situation. What is it that I can do? And the only thing that I could really do that I felt like I was reasonably good at was, you know, picking up the guitar and playing some tunes. And so that's what I did. And people liked it. You know, that's the thing that I noticed was that going around, especially around this country, which still has a great love of the song. It has a love of the process of songwriting, and people come along and they want to listen to what you have to say. So that was a great thing for me. You know, it wasn't necessarily the case where people wanted to come along and just hear the obvious song like Down Under, although I always play it because it's a big song and I still love playing it. But people wanted to hear what you wrote last week as opposed to what you wrote 40 years ago, you know. So it was and still is quite a nourishing thing to do. You know, it's not a bad way to spend. Like, I just got back from doing a month tour here, a month solo tour, and it's the most successful one I've ever done. You know, the rooms are about maybe between 1,000 people and 1,500 people. So that's not like, you know, big stadiums, but the big rooms. And I do that all across the country. And that's all just been word of mouth. It hasn't been through having hit records or anything. It's just been somebody telling somebody else and they bring somebody else along. And it's a pretty rewarding way to perform.
Any song can be played at a funeral. What would you like? Visit TobinBrothers.com.au.
Hi, this is Colin Hay, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
The last time I saw you was at Largo. Man, you had the hottest band. Every player, I watched the whole band, and every player was sensational.
Yeah. Well, I still play at Largo, although it's been in a new venue. It's on La Cienega. Yeah, it used to be on Fairfax, but I still play there. It's a... Because the guy who owns it's a a dear friend of mine. We've been friends since I came over here, since 91, when he got that club, and he said, "Will you come down and play in my club?" And that was like 33 years ago. So it's also a very cool place to play, because you can do what you like there. You can try out new things and develop what it is you want to take to the rest of the country.
Well, Colin Hay provides two shows, all his great songs that he's written, plus a comedy show. I mean, it was just a great experience to go and see Colin Hay on stage, because you get great music, but you're a funny dude.
Well, you do what you can. You know, you try and use what you've got. And again, that wasn't really something where I thought, oh, now I want to be a comedian, or I want to make people laugh. It's just like being on a stage and you're playing the guitar and you're singing. People look at you and you go, okay, well, at some point now, he's probably going to play that guitar again and sing another song. So it's a way of just kind of taking people somewhere else for a minute or two before you get back to playing another song. So it seemed like a natural thing for me to do. It wasn't something that I really planned. It's just something that developed, and then people liked it. And so I just kind of kept doing it and kept doing new things and leaving other things behind. But see, it's always a work in progress. You know, it's never something that's set and you go, okay, that's what it is. It's just like your life. You know, it sure builds up a head of steam the older you get.
Now, we're all looking forward to seeing you in June and July here in Australia to see Colin Hay. Tell me a little bit about your time with Ringo Starr and his all-star band. I mean, you've got Steve Lutica from Toto and Boz Scaggs, Hamish Stewart from Average Weight Band, and Warren Ham from Kansas and Toto. You know, I mean, it's just a super band, isn't it?
The band is Edgar Winter, Steve Lukather, and Hamish Stewart, and Greg Bissonette on drums, and myself and Ring and Warren. Yeah, it's been the same band for a while now. So it's a very, very cool bunch of people to play music with. I never really thought I'd get the chance to do this. You know, I've been playing off and on in Ringo's band for the last 21 years. There's nothing wrong with it. You know, it's the novelty never wears off of playing with one of your all-time heroes. You turn around and Ringo's playing the drums. It's just a beautiful thing. I love it.
And he's just put out a new EP, so you'll be going out touring on the support of that EP too, I should imagine.
Yeah, we go out in a couple of weeks.
We're running out of time, Colin, so I just want to get into a couple of things. What makes you get out of bed every day?
The dog.
I love that. Fantastic. Now, do you have any other hobbies besides writing beautiful songs?
I'm handy in the kitchen, Gavin. It's just a very small little group of people here. Cecilia, my wife, and she has an extended family, whether they're blood, some of them are blood relatives, but most are not. You know, we have a lot of, Cubans and Venezuelans and Peruvians and all kinds of people that seem to end up hanging around most weekends, neighbors. When I'm off the road, that's kind of what it is. It's just people hanging out, and I, you know, take a break from them and go take the dog for a walk, and then if it goes too late for me, I just go to bed.
What kind of dog have you got?
Sadly, we had a dog for a few years who we were completely besotted with. His name is Rico, and he was a pit bull cross. He had suddenly had some kind of maybe thrombosis, or he had a sudden heart attack, and he died about 7 weeks ago. So I had to carry him down to the vet, and he just died right in front of me. It was a completely horrible thing. But Cecilia had seen this other dog, this German Shepherd cross that's in the German Shepherd West Side shelter here in Los Angeles, and had been there for the last 3 or 4 years. And because she's an older girl, nobody would adopt her. So she'd made plans to adopt Tinker, her name is. And we went to South America on tour, and we thought, we'll get her when we come back. So we were going to have her as well. And then Rico passed away, so she went ahead and adopted her. So she's been with us for about 6 weeks, and she's a beautiful girl. She's a shepherd pit bull cross.
Now, Colin Hay, what would you say to a budding young songwriter?
I would just say, get on with it.
You are an absolute superstar, my friend, and I will look forward to seeing you at Hamer Hall. I'm coming to the concert, and I'd love to catch up with you, mate.
Okay, beautiful. All right, thanks a lot.
See you, buddy.
Ciao.
And here's the tour dates for Colin Hay. Saturday, June 29, Costa Hall Geelong, Performing Arts Centre, and there's extra seats available. Sunday, June 30, Hamer Hall, Melbourne Arts Centre, extra seats available there. Wednesday, 3rd of July, Big Red Bash up at Birdsville. Friday, 5th of July, Enmore Theatre in Sydney. Saturday, the 6th of July, Newcastle Civic Centre. And Sunday, the 7th of July, Anita's Theatre, Thirroul.
This podcast brought to you thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals. Celebrating lives every day of the year.